Morning, Oregon, and happy Friday. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show today. This story was first published on October 13th, 2024, under the headline Dispute Over Indians' Land Lasted for 101 Years. It's part two of a two-part presentation. Yesterday, in part one of this series on the McQuinn land strip, we talked about how the initial mistake was made. Today, we'll talk about the Indians' quest to get the government to come through on its end of the deal they made, after confirmation came through that the initial, possibly alcohol-soaked survey that was done on the reservation was in error and had shorted them to the tune of 80,000 acres. But as mentioned at the end of last episode, by the time that survey was corrected, a bunch of settlers had grabbed pieces of the reservation, and they fought furiously against any suggestion that they give it up. Their voices carried more weight in Congress than the Indians did. The Indians at that time were not yet eligible to vote. So Congress dithered. It formed a commission to study the problem. The commission basically said, yeah, the Indians were cheated out of their rightful legal due, but who cares? They're Indians. So the commission said, yeah, let's just stick with the faulty survey and tell the tribes to suck it up. Life's not fair.
We have changed the deal. Pray we do not alter it any further, as it were.
The tribes tried to ignore the blatant disrespect and continued to protest and argue for their rights under the treaty. In 1917, Congress tried to solve the problem by throwing money at it. Hey, here's some money. We can buy you out. The tribes were like, no, thank you. We want our land. We want, you know, what is ours. Then in 1930, Congress decided to toss this hot potato over to the judicial branch, giving the tribes clearance to sue over it, which they promptly did, and so was launched one of the most outrageous legal farces of Oregon history. The court, in 1941, ruled that yes, the Indians were entitled to the land of the McQuinn Strip. However, the judge ruled they could not simply have their property back. Instead, they would have to accept payment for it. The proposal for payment was the best part, and by best, I pretty much mean worst. The judge started off by decreeing that the stolen land would have been worth $1 an acre in 1871. Land was actually selling for $5 to $15 an acre during that time, depending on how well-watered and productive it was, and the McQuinn Strip probably would have landed somewhere in the middle of that range. But therefore, at $1 an acre, the judge announced that the Indians were entitled to $80,925 plus interest, which would have come to $241,084. But, he added, the government had spent $252,089, quote, in behalf of the tribes during that same period. So actually, the Indians needed to hand over the land and pay the government an extra $11,005 for the privilege. I haven't been able to learn for sure whether the tribes took this as an insult, but surely they must have. Wouldn't anyone? In any case, the tribes rejected the offer, and with the, it has to be said, the patience of Job, continued to protest. But this really obvious show of bad faith on the court's part seems to have raised the tribe's profile in some important places. In 1943, Oregon Senator Charles McNary and Representative Lowell Stockman introduced a bill that would have cut straight to the heart of the matter, simply revising the reservation boundaries where the McQuinn line is and letting the chips fall where they might. The Roosevelt administration's Department of Justice, that would be J. Edgar Hoover and friends, and also Department of Agriculture, home of the Forest Service, which controlled most of the land in the strip, lobbied against it, and it failed. But after the war, in 1948, Oregon Senator Guy Cordon tried again, introducing a bill that, rather than changing the boundary, simply required the government to give the tribes the gross revenues in grazing fees and timber sales from the disputed lands. This proposal passed relatively easily, probably because the government wasn't getting very much revenue from it. That changed, though, as the years went by, and by 1970, the tribes had banked almost $6 million from this deal. This income stream helped the tribes build their legendary Caneta Resort in the 1960s. But around the end of the 60s, lawmakers started working behind the scenes to get all parties on board with a plan to give the land back for real. Representative Al Ullman took the point on it, and by the time he was introducing the bill to give the land back in late 1971, there was widespread agreement that it was high time to make things right. This seems to have been news to John McGuire, the chief of the Forest Service, though. In what seems to have been intended as a surprise move to kill the bill, late in the process, McGuire suddenly announced that the Nixon administration opposed the bill. He said the Forest Service wanted to spend 2 years on a study of all the borders of all the Indian reservations before considering signing off on adjusting this one. Was he playing for time? Was he hoping the Forest Service would pick up a few acres in the process? Whatever the motive, it made little difference, because a few weeks later, Senators Mark Hatfield and Bob Packwood got an identical bill out of the Senate Interior Committee, and by early August, it had passed the Senate with ease. The following month, it passed in the House, literally unanimously. When the bill landed on President Nixon's desk, he promptly signed it. Whether McGuire was right or not in saying his administration opposed it, it had passed by more than enough points to be veto-proof, so Nixon didn't waste any political capital bothering about it. And that is how, at long last, after 85 years of intransigent possession of stolen property, the U.S. government finally gave the Warm Springs Indians back their land. The tribes took possession of all the public lands and announced that the owners of private lands in the McQuinn Strip would have their property rights respected as they always were, but that if they should ever want to sell, the tribes would make them an offer. Key sources in this story included an unbylined article in the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs website and articles by Joshua Bynus and George W. Lynn. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. And by the way, if you haven't yet, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're a lot like these columns, only expanded and updated to take advantage of a less restrictive format. We've got Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, Bad Ideas and Horrible People in Old Oregon, and eventually the plan is for 8 of them to be out, although how many there are out right now depends on when you hear this. They're a lot of fun and would look great on your bookshelf. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m., so it'll be a couple of days before you get your next fix. But of course, Monday morning will be here before we know it. And that's the latest news from here in Offbeat Oregon's Sulphur Springs studio. So now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.